part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com. Okay, so this is the pod. Screwed up.
Over.
This is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. My
yes.
name is Christian Horn. And
yes.
I'm speaking very slowly and clearly. I am on the line with my good friend David Schrader, who with me or has mostly been the mastermind behind the comic Baby Badass.
Yes, and the mastermind.
I am the co-creator, and we should tell people that this weekend we are going to be at the Long Beach Comic Con.
Come full circle, Christian, full circle.
Full circle, yes.
In 2015, we were there together and launched.
Was it 2015?
That was 2015, so 3 years ago. We had our solo book for Baby Badass, and then, you know, Action Lab picked it up. It took 3 more years, but it launched this year. I got published, and it's a little mini cult hit for Action Lab.
Come around. Yeah. So Baby yes. Badass, what booth number? I think you had said like D20.
D20.
Artist Alley? Artist Alley?
I don't know, because I somehow got invited as a guest too, so I don't know if it's a little different. So
Dave's the
D20, our table's D20. Come if you're going to be there, check us out if anyone is listening before we get to Ishtar.
Yeah. Yes. No, definitely come to Long Beach Comic Con. I'll also have some things of my own, a little bit of Periwinkle post giveaways and little knickknacks to sell, and maybe some postcard art and stuff like that. We're going to see how much space is at the table, but primarily, we're there to sell Baby Badass, the comic book smash hit
yes.
from Action Lab.
It'll be a real hootenanny.
It's going to be a hootenanny. It always is at
right.
Long Beach. Long Beach is
that
a
should,
good show. It's a fun
should be
show.
Fun.
Yeah, it should be fun. But we are not here to talk about ourselves.
No, enough Baby Badass and Periwinkle Puss and all that stuff.
Yeah, we are not here to self-promote ourselves, even though this is my podcast. And
that's right.
I talk to people to promote about things on the podcast, on said podcast. We are here to talk about, you already kind of spilled the beans a little earlier.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
No, I'm assuming this is in the title of the podcast, so if someone clicks on it, so they want to
yeah, that's a good assumption. But
right.
I like to keep the listeners in suspense in case anyone comes across us by accident.
By accident.
Yeah.
Right. So does that happen a lot, Kristen? People are...
I don't even know if people are visiting me on purpose. I really need to be on top of it with this.
Okay.
But we are here to chat about the
drum roll.
Cinematic legend, Ishtar.
That's right.
Dun, dun, dun.
For all the like 50 people out there in the world that really love this movie, this is this podcast for you.
So, okay. So every once in a while, as listeners know, we like to chat about movies on this podcast. And I kind of call it the PTF Film Club. And, you know, usually we chat about we kind of got it started with Corey Blake, who has been on the podcast several times. He had wanted to go down the list of I forget what list it was, like AFI, or whatever, and chat about the 100 greatest films of all time or something. And we've kind of meandered, and we've done episodes about bad superhero movies and stuff like that. And I don't think we've done a film club episode in quite a while. So
does this count? Is this part of it?
Yes, this is part of it. No, that's why I'm saying the introduction.
The part-time fanboy film club. It's
part-time fanboy film club. That's
subsidiary.
Right.
Okay.
Subsidiary of the original podcast. Well, we talk about all kinds of stuff here, but the reason we are talking about Ishtar is because I think you were on Facebook and one of our friends had posted something about favorite movies or movies that you could watch over and over again or movies that were not highly regarded that we loved and stuff.
I think that was it. Yeah, one of those.
And you had said Ishtar, and I saw that comment because Facebook is basically Big Brother watching everyone, us all watching each other. And I was like, huh, I've never seen Ishtar. I've just never had the chance to see it because it's to see it because it's got such a terrible
reputation.
And but that never stopped me from watching a movie that was considered kind of like bad. You know,
yeah, but this is considered, and I'm going to say unfairly so, like all-time bad. There was even a Far Side cartoon Gary Larson did a long time ago, and it was called Hell's Video Store. And all was just VHS tapes of Ishtar.
Yeah.
And later they asked Gary Larson about it. He goes, you know, honestly, I never even saw it. It was just, I was just going using an example. And so my whole thing is people that don't like Ishtar either, one, didn't see it, or two, have a really shitty sense of humor. I wouldn't trust someone that has a, like, that I would think like, oh, they have a really good sense of humor and they saw Ishtar and didn't like that. That wouldn't jive with me. That wouldn't seem right. It's, you might not love it and it might not be your favorite, but it's certainly not the worst movie ever made. And it is funny, at least in sections, you know what I'm saying? So at least in large swaths of the movie, it is pretty funny. And smart people that I know that have liked it, that have seen it have liked it. And in fact, back in high school, I was 17 when this came out. And I didn't see it in the theater because just like everyone else, I heard it was, you know, this bomb.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw it on video. So it was probably like the late 87, maybe early 88 or whatever, where we just loved it. We thought it was hilarious. And the bad songs and so, we were playing basketball on the court.
Who did you see it with? Like, was
I probably saw it with my brother, and I'll tell you more about how much he loves it later. My brother, and then I had some friends at school, and we watched it and they thought it was great too. It was, you know, the movies I loved in high school, Fletch was a big one that we watched a lot of. I mean, obviously like a lot of the National Lampoon movies and things like that, but Ishtar was kind of right up there back in that time. And it was, you know, part of the charm of it was the fact that everyone else hated it or thought it was so horrible. So it was kind of like being a part of a secret club.
Sure, sure, sure. So you watched it maybe like at home with your family or your brother? Or...
Yeah, the whole family thought it was great too. Like, I mean, my family watches, I mean, we loved Arthur kind of, the original Dustin. Yeah. I'm trying to think of movies that we watched again and again. And this turned into one, like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah, that's which a fantastic was, I think, movie too.
I think it was the same year as Ishtar, right? 87?
I'm not sure, but I did pull up a list of most popular feature films and just general movies released in 87. And 1987 was an amazing, like really, really good movie.
Right.
Year, really good year for movies. Like I'm like, let me just go down the list a little bit.
Okay.
I'm just looking at the Internet Movie Database. Now they've got them listed. I don't know in what order this is. I don't know if it's an order of release date or gross or whatever. Predator, The Princess Bride, Dirty Dancing, Full Metal Jacket, Lost Boys, The Untouchables, Spaceballs, Overboard.
I think this order is alphabetical.
Yeah, Empire of the Sun,
right.
RoboCop.
Which is funny, Empire of the Sun, I believe the cinematographer of Ishtar did that as well.
Yeah.
Vittorio, how do you say his last name, Satoru?
No idea. I did not look up the cinematographer for this movie right now.
No, but he's amazing. He's like won Academy Awards. He did Apocalypse Now. Like he's like this, that's why it looks so good.
Uh-huh.
Ishtar actually looks beautiful. Like it's shot beautifully. And they had all kinds of problems. Like there was all kinds of infighting on the set. I mean, there's a whole backstory to this.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
Yeah.
Continue your non-alphabetical list.
Just finishing the list off, like just to show you what a great movie year this. Lethal Weapon, starring the now disgraceful Mel Gibson, but it's still a great movie. Some Kind of Wonderful, Fatal Attraction, Can't Buy Me Love, Witches of Eastwick, Raising Arizona, Mannequin, which I love, is a bad movie that I love.
That is a bad movie.
Evil Dead 2. Wall Street, No Way Out, Angel Heart, Moonstruck, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Adventures in Babysitting, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Yeah.
So, I've seen like all of these movies about it. Maybe everyone is this way around the age 17. You see a lot of movies. At least we did back then. And I saw all these movies. And it was a good year for movies.
It wasn't.
It was what I wanted to do. I mean, I was 17. I didn't know. I mean, 2 years later, I was out here in Los Angeles, but I appreciated comedy and I loved comedy. And I think there was a lot of good ones that year. I was wrong. It was The Last Emperor that this guy, the cinematographer.
Oh, gotcha. So he also did, let it be known that this was the year that Superman IV, The Quest for Peace came out, which is garbage.
That's really dragged down that list.
Yeah, that's dragging down the list.
All right.
But so yeah, it was a really great year for movies. So is this something that maybe you just like picked up in the video store? Like,
no, I'd heard about it and I'm trying to think, because why did I think I just heard about it. Dustin Hoffman was a big star then. You know, it was only a year later he won an Oscar for Rain Man. Like it wasn't like this was some weird aberration and you know, these guys couldn't act or Elaine May couldn't write and direct. Like, it was just a really weird like set of circumstances that I think made this movie so maligned. Yeah. But I mean, Warren Beatty I thought was great, but I never thought he was better than this movie. Like Dustin Hoffman too. I think it's like their best performances, but they were big enough stars and there was enough story about like what was going on with this movie that it piqued people's interest. They wanted to know what this was about. And it became fashionable, I think, to just kind of bash it for a lot of reasons. But we loved it just because the comedy and I think the writing is superb. And we'll get into that later if you want.
Well, I think we should talk a little bit about like sort of the background, like the time this movie was made in. I mean, we're talking like mid to late 80s. And I think Cold War, strictly Cold War. Yeah, definitely Cold War, but also an era in Hollywood where it was like the stars made the movie. Like you could not, like stars could get a director fired. If you were a big star, everyone knew who you were. There was no Netflix. There was no Hulu. You were going to the theater and that's where you saw your movies, and maybe you would see stuff like on TV that was cut up and edited, right. You know, and if you had lucky enough to have HBO. But for the most part, like this was an era where you had video stores and you had movie houses, movie theaters. Look at me, I'm such an old man. Movie houses.
You went to the back movie in my house. Day, they had movie houses.
That's right. You got
and they didn't have
bugs.
Fancy chairs that reclined.
Exactly.
You sat on a tech.
We didn't have sound. There was no
and you
sound.
Liked it.
but also,
Warren Beatty was a huge star. Yeah. You know, people forget. And he was a producer, too. And he produced this movie.
Yeah, as was Dustin Hoffman. I mean,
they both were. I mean, they were giant stars, and Warren Beatty owed Elaine May because she co-wrote Heaven Can Wait, another great film. That's another reason why I like Warren Beatty.
Which is like an early 80s movie, isn't it?
No, 70, that's 78.
Oh, yeah, 78.
So Heaven Can Wait was 78, and she co-wrote that with Buck Henry. It's really funny. It's really charming and smart.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
And she also did like a rewrite or something on Tootsie. So Dustin Hoffman kind of liked her. So they all had some connections
Let's talk about Elaine May just a little bit, because I mean, I pulled up, obviously she's kind of a comedic legend. You know,
she was pretty young. I don't think they were married. I think they were just comedy partners. Maybe they were together, but.
Oh, I thought that they did marry, but maybe they weren't.
I apologize if I don't know that, but I know that they were a legendary team and like really helped develop improv just as we know it.
Yeah. I mean, she's a comedy legend, and she started out doing improv with Mike Nichols, and you can hear some of the recordings online of like their routines, and they're really funny. I mean, I would recommend, you know, checking them out.
Right. It's smart and funny, which is like the best kind of comedy. And so she was a great writer. She did a movie called The Heartbreak Kid. Anyone out there wants to watch the original one?
Yeah,
the Farrelly Brothers one is really funny. I love the one with Ben Stiller. It's hilarious. But the old one is also funny in almost like a darker way. If anyone doesn't know the story, it's like Charles Grodin plays this guy that is married to this girl, and they're on their honeymoon, and he falls in love with Sybil Shepherd, and he like leaves his wife on their honeymoon. It's a really brutal,
yeah,
but still like dark, funny movie. And Charles Grodin's great. He's never gotten his due. We can do another podcast about Midnight Run and how great he is in that. But he's also an Ishtar, and he is amazing in it, in all of his scenes. And it's like all the little parts. There's so many little things in this movie, little lines, little takes, little slow burns that are like, it's part of the writing too. And Elaine May, getting back to her, was a perfectionist. And that's part of why they had so many problems. I think this movie, she would do like 50 takes or something. Like the scene with the vultures, they weren't landing just right. And people were like losing their shit because they were just in the desert looking for the perfect sand dune. I mean, these are the kind of things that it happens when you're a perfectionist, but maybe this movie wouldn't be as good as I think it is, and as stand the test of time if she wasn't a perfectionist. You know what I mean?
Well, it's funny because sort of part of the reason that Warren Beatty did this as a favor to her, according to, you know, Wikipedia and other online sources. What was that?
According to Wikipedia?
Yeah, according to Wikipedia and other online articles that I've read, was that... I don't know how fair or unfair it is to say, but that whenever she made a movie, there was usually sort of like trouble between her and the studio, or her and the people that she was making movies for. Like, just reading her biography on Wikipedia, her first movie, which I really want to check out because apparently this is a really great movie, it's called The New Leaf. And originally she submitted a 180 minute cut, and the studio cut it back to 80 minutes for release. And there is also an incident, I'm not sure which movie it was, but where she actually sort of apparently kidnapped the work print of a film because she was having problems with the producers and the studio, and was like, I'm not giving you my movie unless you do kind of what I want with it. So obviously, yeah, she's a perfectionist, but you've also sort of gotten someone who maybe by the time this movie was going to be released was not in sort of good graces with the studio, you know what I mean?
Maybe, maybe not. But I mean, I think some of that's going to come down to let's face it. I mean, it's a female director, so maybe she wasn't allowed to get away with some of the things that a male director would be. Oh, he's a perfectionist, and with her, it's a problem.
Yeah, I absolutely don't disagree.
You know, and so in a lot of ways, it's amazing that this even got made at all, and they had the budget they did. I think the original budget was supposed to be like 28 million, and it eventually got closer to like 40 or 50 million, which was, you know, people lost their shit about it.
Yeah.
And now you look at like, now they're making movies for like $500 million, and you're like, fuck, you know, they made this. You know, this comedy that has lasted the test of time for, it's not that much, you know, and people freaked out about that. That became part of the narrative, I think, when people hated on it so much back then.
Well, I think this is also a byproduct of the era that it was made in, which is an era of sort of excess in Hollywood. And I think that there are a lot of people in the town at the time who justifiably, not justifiably, kind of got tired of big stars sort of like using their weight to push people around in Hollywood.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because the guy that took over Columbia Pictures while this movie was being made or in post-production was David Putnam. And he was like this guy that this British dude that he came from a different world, and he hated the what he considered the waste in the movie business, and particularly like he had a vendetta against Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman like separately. So all of that played into the studio not really supporting the movie and all that other stuff. But
yeah, but we also do have to say that, like, I mean, Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman, a lot of celebrities at the time, they were known for out of control egos. I mean, there was a lot of excess on like movie sets. You know what I'm saying? Like,
thankfully, that's all over now.
Yeah, I know, right? No, right. But I'm saying like this was definitely, I think now it's a little different in that celebrities can't push studios and producers around as or directors around as they could maybe back then. You know what I'm saying? It was definitely a different time. And if you sort of like read books about like Hollywood or articles, like I remember I used to read a lot of like movie magazines and like Premiere, and you would just hear like all these, whether it was gossip or whatever.
I read Premiere too. I mean, when you think about it, that was like a gossip rag for people that were into movies.
It was a great magazine though. They would have articles about filmmaking and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So I used to love Premiere. I used to read it, but I do think that this sort of like movie, that this movie in particular is very much a product of like a weird, perfect storm that kind of surrounded it at the time of like Hollywood excess and in studio fighting and, you know, just everything.
Right. It had
crazy.
All of that. And I think, like you said, it was a perfect storm. Yeah. But in a way that kind of sets it apart even more. There's a lot of juicy, crazy stuff about it. Yeah. And that can be kind of fun, you know, looking back now. And I think this is the kind of movie that, you know, I'm a big Lebowski fan, and I've gone to several of the Lebowski Fest. Yeah. I think this is the kind of movie that could have something similar. Like you just have a screening and invite people that like it, and that could grow. Because the music also, we haven't talked about the music, but Paul Williams co-wrote these songs with Elaine May. And that they are, you know, he talked about it, like he had the most fun and worked as hard as he's ever worked in his career writing these songs, because they had to purposely be bad, but also memorably bad and funny. And they are funny. I mean, there's lines like when Warren Beatty's singing, you know, she said, come look, there's a wardrobe of love in my eyes. Take your time, look around, see if there's something your size. You know, this is the beginning part where they're just working on their stuff, sure, which is great because it's about the creative process. It's about the indignities of show business. It's all of those things all wrapped up. And again, they switched roles a little bit. Like, you know, Dustin Hoffman played a little bit of the ladies' man, the confident guy, even though ultimately he's not. Warren Beatty's the bumbler. And a lot of this was based on Elaine May wanted to do a Hope and Crosby road movie. You know, those old road movies where they went to Morocco and, you know, they're in the desert. So there's a lot of big ideas, because she folded in the Cold War. She folded in CIA espionage and like the shitty ways we support some of these countries. And I mean, she had some like, you know, kind of progressive politics mixed into this big movie that also had very small moments about these losers. And when you think about it, American audiences, sometimes they don't want to see their movie stars play losers. And that's what these two guys were, really funny losers that, like, to me has this amazing, memorable dialogue, and the songs are just, they're fantastic. And I don't know. Maybe people expected something different when they went into this, and I'm sure they did. And it was, you know, it just didn't hit right when it came out. Although I'm going to tell you this, I think Vincent Canby in the New York Times, and there were some other reviews early that were great reviews, and people forget this because then it started getting buried about all the stories about, oh, how much it cost, all the infighting. I think Beatty and Hoffman wanted to be filmed for their interviews instead of on video, because there was some vanity there. And I think that rubbed people the wrong way. It's like, really, we're going to shoot film to do these interviews? But, it didn't help their cause. And the cause is the movie is just, it's a funny, crazy kind of movie.
Well, it's not known for being humble, or it was never known for being humble.
He's held a career.
You see, so Dave, you said a lot of things in the beginning of the podcast about the type of person that you consider likes this movie.
All right,
here
we go. The
type of person that doesn't.
That's right, because we don't know what Christian thinks. I've been asking him. He's like, I'm going to save it for the podcast. This is his big reveal. People, what Christian Horn, the part-time fanboy, thinks about Ishtar, and he's going to... do you want to give a rating first out of 5 stars?
I don't want to give a rating. I'm just going to say... this is a bad movie.
Oh, You've seen it once. I've seen it 200 times. I think I can probably tell you more than that.
That's great. I wouldn't want to watch it a second time.
You have to. This is the kind of movie you would have to. It's like Lebowski. It's like the people that trashed Lebowski early on.
Dude,
like
when I first saw Lebowski, I loved it.
It requires repeated viewings. If you don't get the nuance.
No. Okay, I'm going to...
A bad movie.
Look, I'm not... Look, I'm not trying to get into, like, I don't want us to get into, like, a shouting match over Ishtar on the podcast.
We should. This is going to be like Crossfire. I told you it would be.
No. But, okay, I'm going to list you. I mean, you've said a lot of things that you like about the movie. And okay. I'm going to say the things that I disliked, and we can agree or disagree. First of all, I do not think it is good. I do think it deserved to bomb. I think that it very much wears the 80s excess on its sleeve. You can tell that there are chunks of the story that are not complete. There are chunks of the script that are meandering. There's definitely scenes that just stop to a halt. I think, and I'm just, you know, there's positive things in this movie. I'm just leading with why I don't think this is a good movie.
Real quick, did you prefer the New York stuff with the songwriting and didn't like that when they get into the desert and like the helicopters and all that? Or does it not matter for you? Because some people are of the mind, oh, I like the songs, I like that stuff, and they should have stayed in New York, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't like when you know, the movie goes somewhere else.
No, I think, well, first of all, there's definitely chunks of this movie that are completely racist or prejudiced towards Middle East people. I will
say. Oh, my God. Seriously.
No.
The main actress is not. Her brother is not.
Dave,
which scene when he's the
oh yeah, you know,
oh
because you know what I'm gonna say
you're talking about when Hoffman is the interpreter.
Yes.
There's some really funny stuff. There's some really funny stuff there.
Wait, let me stop you.
First of all, it's making fun of him. He's such an idiot. The only like words he knows, he's saying Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Funny. There's nothing racist about that, right?
No, I mean, and you're not like Dustin Hoffman, like performance in that scene is decent, but the whole thing is really racist, dude. Like, it's really racist. And I'm watching it and I'm like, I can't. And I get it. It's a different era. Like, I could pull any list of those movies that we talked about, like just like pulling one off of like one of that's my favorite, Can't Buy Me Love. It's about a girl, a guy who wants to be popular. And he hires a girl to date him. So it's basically about teenage prostitution. Like, yeah, and it was like all funny and light and stuff like that. But no, this part and issue, what are you doing? Are you banging on something?
No, I had my clicker here. I was moving it. Sorry, I didn't know you could hear that.
No,
I'm gnashing my teeth because I'm so outraged that you.
No, and this is fine. We can disagree. Like
honestly, that scene, I don't know. He sends Warren Beatty down to get water because they're out of water.
No,
and then he's discovered like laying up there, and the British guys are like, "Hey, can you come? You know, can you come down here? And this is our interpreter." So are you talking about the scene where he's trying to interpret?
Yes.
But I'm talking about the whole thing. It's just him just acting like a fool.
I feel comfortable watching that with a group of like Middle Eastern people. I like that scene. I would be like, ooh, this is really inappropriate because they're seen as like really dumb and buying into like whatever stupid thing that he's doing. And it is.
No, they're not at all. You missed it. That's why you've only seen it once. They're actually pointing to their ears like this doesn't make sense.
Yeah, no, I know. But in the end, Warren Beatty speaks up and he's like they run all over and they follow him and whatever.
Oh God, you are so hypersensitive sometimes.
Here we go, I'm hypersensitive.
You are. That's all right.
Let me say that. I think the biggest problem with this movie, and you're going to disagree with me, is it's miscast. I think that, and I'm not talking about that they did bad performances. I'm talking about that these two guys, and this is my opinion, okay, regarding Ishtar, are too old to play these parts. They're too old because It would be one thing in the movie if they had said, like, they were older, washed up, or they were trying to do something else with their lives, or, you know, I was selling cars, and now I want to be a songwriter, and I'm just going to abandon it to follow my dream. In this movie, the narrative is very much like they're songwriters, kind of from the beginning. Warren Beatty drives, like, a little...
He drives an ice cream truck.
Ice cream truck, which seems like... weird for the level of income that he's got, but okay.
No, because he moved with his wife. He talks about the tire factory close. You don't know because you don't remember the dialogue because you've only seen this movie one time.
But I don't need to see it because it was so boring.
But you're wrong about that. Like, he lived in Nashville with his wife. He moved there with his wife because he said that's where songwriters are, and then the tire factory closed or something, and that's why they moved to New York
But for me, and not to be ageist, this very much... First of all, there are definitely parts of the script that don't address, like, why are these guys so old and pursuing their dream now? To me, it would have been much funnier with a younger, two leading men who were younger.
But they've been pursuing their dream for a long time. They're terrible. That's part of it.
Well...
And they didn't know each other. They just met. And if you would watch the movie more than once, you'd know that they had just met when they were older. They were individually pursuing their dreams. Yes, but
they just met. Dustin Hoffman is like a singer in a piano bar and doesn't really realize that he's...
Right. And let me throw this out there. I love it because he points out this couple that's having their anniversary party there. And he's like, a few years ago, they came, a nice couple came for their 51st wedding anniversary. And then the next year they came back at their 52nd. I told them they'd come back again. Yeah. I'd have a song for them. I love that this is the kind of place he works at where someone comes for their 51st wedding anniversary, not their 50th, of course. So that's the little nuance and the kind of dialogue that Elaine May writes that is so good. And it's littered throughout this movie, that kind of stuff.
You're not
Little lines, like Jack Weston is great in it. Yes. Groden's great in it. I mean,
oh no, Groden is horribly misused. He's terrible. Groden is a great actor, and those scenes were just too long. They just dragged too long. They should have been more quippy with what he's usually does, and it would have his scenes would have been much more successful. But no. The point is
even the scene where he's talking to Dustin Hoffman and he's like, especially since Gaddafi made his move, and Dustin Hoffman's like, is that near here? He's like,
yeah, no, that's funny.
Gaddafi in Libya.
The thing is I'm not disagreeing. let me speak because I'm trying to say something nice about it.
Okay, great.
The thing is you're not wrong about bits of dialogue that are sprinkled through, but the thing is that the pacing of the film is so all over the place and scenes don't quite fit together that it's just like a hodgepodge. And by the end, for me, I was just bored and wanted it to be over. Like, I did not like Warren Beatty and these two characters in this movie. And obviously it has to do with whatever production and editing. I think there was even trouble with the cinematographer and the director fighting and the editor and the director fighting.
Well, some of that was because Elaine May wants to, frame things for comedy. And the cinematographer who was brilliant too was doing it for the look, but I think it still worked. That's my opinion.
But
there's a lot of philosophy in this movie too. That little lines and the things about their age is they were still chasing their dreams. There's something kind of sweet and beautiful about all that. There's a line where Warren Beatty says, when Dustin Hoffman's out on the ledge, literally on the ledge, and he's singing, making up a song, because that's what he's doing, like, through the movie.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, it takes a lot of nerve to have nothing at your age. Most guys would be ashamed. But you've got the guts to say the hell with it. You say you'd rather have nothing than settle for less. And the line about, like, most men lead lives of quiet desperation, that most people would rather suffer with what they have than try the unknown.
Yeah.
Those are all themes. And I think you need to have people that have been through the ringer in life to go through that. I think if you had two 22-year-olds in a road movie, who gives a shit?
But these guys aren't 22. They're freaking like 45.
That's
like
what I'm
50.
Saying. If you had that would be no good. These characters have been through life and they failed. And so you want to see them kind of succeed.
No, but they're so dumb that you sort of don't identify with them. So earlier you were talking about the road movies like Bob Hope and Bing Crosby and, you know, stuff like that. And the thing is like those guys exuded charm and the dialogue worked and it was pitter patter and it bounced back and forth. These two together.
No, just, I actually think those are a little more, they're more a little smarmier than you remember. Again, like I find these two guys much more appealing than Hope and Crosby. That's my opinion.
No way. Oh yes. My God. No way. The first of all, so let's talk about Hope and Crosby movies. I'm not going to say that like I'm a huge fan of like Hope and Crosby and stuff, but when they worked, their stuff is like legendary, and this is nowhere near that. These guys these characters don't have the charm or the sympathy or anything like even close to those movies. I mean, I'm just going to disagree with you like that on a fundamental basis. Like Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman, they don't necessarily have chemistry working together. Warren Beatty is great as the dumb guy. Like he's great playing against type, but at the same time, it's like, it's like weird. Like Dustin Hoffman, it just doesn't click. It's like, I don't know like what he's trying to do with his character, but
we can agree to disagree. No, and absolutely. I'll just say that you're wrong.
No, but, you don't trust me.
Now, you're wrong, but that's person. Okay.
No, I mean, but the thing of it is like, I don't disagree with you that there's not like really nice bits of dialogue sprinkled through the movie.
It's not sprinkled, Christian. I said littered because it's literally every scene there's something like that. And to me, as a writer,
they don't land consistently. The jokes don't land like consistently, sometimes they seem to be like crammed into the dialogue when somebody's talking, and it's just like, what is the point of sort of this scene, and where are we going with this?
Like. Did you, as a sidebar, did you notice that like when he's out on the ledge, like his parents are there trying to get him in?
And, oh, absolutely.
And they're like the original Costanzas. Like when you hear them, it's like, this boy doesn't want to live with us in Queens. And the mom is like a floozy that's like singing. And now you know why he is the way he is. Like, because she's saying the sun will come out tomorrow. And then she starts breaking into song like while her son's out on the ledge.
Yeah. But, and some bits of that scene like really work. Like when Warren Beatty goes out and the parent bit.
Yeah, it's touching.
Really worked for me. Yeah. And the thing is I'm not going to say like, first of all, I'm not going to say that this is like the worst movie I've ever seen. For
Thank
God's
you.
Sake. Like,
Jesus.
No. I'm not, well, I'm, that's not what I'm saying, but I'm also not going to say that it's a good movie or that I enjoyed it because I kind of didn't. There are bits of like, there are like I said, there is some scene work in there that like, okay, the first bit with them playing in the nightclub where Warren Beatty is playing on the bongos and stuff like that.
Right.
Like that I thought was really funny, but definitely there were points where it's like, okay, this is going on too long. And I think that in this movie, you can see the troubled production like right through it. Like I'm like this, like the fact that it ended up as decently as it did to me is kind of like a miracle. And I don't know who should take credit for that. Would it be Warren Beatty or Elaine May? Like, what do you think?
Well, I think they all kind of had a hand in it, like at one point or the other. What's interesting to me is I had this director's cut on. This is like the first director's cut that apparently it's shorter. It's like the director's cut that's 2 minutes shorter. I was like, that's odd. But I don't know. I mean, there was all kinds of, I think your outlook got colored a little bit by knowing and reading some of this stuff before you watched it, as opposed to just watching it.
I watched it before I read. I actually watched it before I read. Well, and you know, the thing of it is like, and I watched it with an open mind. I wanted to like this. I did not want to dislike it. I don't go into it like hating things, you know,
right.
But for me, it's like, it just didn't click. And for whatever reason, and I'm not going to say that like you have a bad taste in movies because you don't, because every movie that you listed before that, like comedies, I love too. You know what I mean? I mean, you and I have had conversations about movie, but you know, you're talking to a guy who likes Howard the Duck. So like,
right.
You know, take that for what it's worth. And Howard the Duck, I'm going to tell you, is not a good movie, but it's kind of entertaining in a weird, bizarre, like, how the fuck did this get made sort of thing.
This is not that. And this, honestly, I just feel like it is one of those things that if you see it again or you catch a scene on TV and you watch it again, I think that grows because there is so much nuance in this that I don't think people get it, and they gloss over. They look at the bigger picture, and this scene happens, and this happens. Like, it is all threaded through it. The dialogue, the pathos, like,
I know. I picked up on everything. It just did not hit the way that it I felt that it should have hit. It wasn't,
right.
I mean, it wasn't a strong thread through the movie. So, like, if we're talking comedy, do you know what this reminded me of? Particularly, like, Cold War and stuff like this. Do you know what I'm going to say?
Spies Like Us?
Yes. Like, I was watching this, and I was like,
this is
I would
like,
much rather
this
watch
is, I love Spies Like Us. And Spies Like Us is great, but this is way more of a film. And then Spies Like Us. You know, John Landis made Spies Like Us, and it's kind of a throwaway, and it's goofy, it's Chevy Chase. But you're right, they are kind of siblings. This is there's more to this. This goes a lot deeper. And I'll stake my comedy claim on that. I will say that. My brother loves this movie so much. And probably the only guy that loves Ishtar maybe more than me is my brother. He recorded this from a VHS tape to like a cassette tape. So when he's on trips, he put it in because there's so much music in it too. Like, did you at least like think the songs were all fucking funny? Because they really are. Like, they are horribly bad. They are hilarious. And Paul Williams, again, he should get a lot of credit for that. Elaine May too, and they're all throughout the movie. It's not just when they're in the beginning part. I mean, they kind of sing some different things here and there, but when they're in Morocco, they're going to sing their own songs, and even their covers are funny. Like, the stuff that's going on in the background all the time reminds me of Bottle Rocket, which is another one of my favorites, and the lines of dialogue that you don't even see on screen sometimes are the funniest. Like, in Bottle Rocket, there's a scene where Owen Wilson's yelling at in the kitchen about something, and he's like, "How the fuck did that's an asshole like Bob get such a great kitchen?" Like, and they're both off screen, and you can barely hear it. You know, it's little things like that, and this movie has a lot of that throughout it. And so, to me, that's where the repeated viewings come in. And because I have seen it that many times, and the only other movie I've seen as much, maybe it's Lebowski, and
I'd have to say great.
Planes, Trains, because we watch it every Thanksgiving, Christmas Vacation, because we watch it every year. But like, this is one that like I watched a lot. Arthur was another one. Like, I'm talking about some Fletch a million times. I've seen it, you know. So those things come out as you see it again and again and again. And I know it sounds painful to you because you didn't like it, but this movie has that. There's a lot of dialogue back and forth that's very layered.
And I don't disagree with you at all on that. I don't disagree with you, but I feel in my estimation of this film that the humor doesn't play as well as it could with the dialogue that's there. And I feel a lot of bits are overworn, in particular the songs. Like, I think the songs are great after a while, and then it's like halfway through the movie, it's like, okay, I get it. Like, that's not funny anymore. It was funny before, but it's kind of like wearing me down. Because like, for me, it's like these two characters, like as the movie went on, I'll tell you what, like, I really started, there's definitely a bit like where they get lost in the desert.
Right.
I was like, this is kind of fun, you know, where I mean, like, he doesn't realize that he's told by Isabel. First of all, Isabella Gianni is like great in it. First, she's beautiful. She's like one of my favorite actresses. She's one of those like Demi Moore actresses that can sort of like just cry on cue.
She has a very sad, very sad classic kind of face, you know.
And I've seen her in other things, and she's always been one of my favorites. And she's the best thing in the movie, but she's not Middle Eastern, for God's sake. Like, this is like totally one of those eras where it's just like, hey, does somebody have a foreign accent? They must be foreign. Like, all foreigners are the same.
I don't feel it's quite like that, but go ahead.
It's definitely that era where you're talking about, like, it was okay for Mickey Rooney to play a an Asian guy.
That's a little different. That's further.
No, absolutely. I'm exaggerating.
Isabella Gianni actually could pass for Middle Eastern. She actually looks like she could be. So, and plus, her face is covered through half the movie anyhow. This is 1987. I hear what you're saying,
covered that much because she's obviously the beautiful lady that they need to sort of focus on.
At the very end, you see her with her hair for the first time. But, it's funny you said that about the desert thing, because, like, getting back to my brother, he still says it to this day. He's like 30 years later, There's a scene where they're in the desert on the camel all night because the camel, because there's a wind and it's blowing and they can't see and the camel is blind, everyone should know about that in Ishtar. They actually had a real blind camel. That's one of the things they had to find, a blind camel.
Didn't something happen where like somebody ran off to get the camel and then they lost the camel and it got like eaten by people? Like
there is some crazy story like that, but it's the detail again of what they wanted, needed, and like how long it took. But so they're on this camel and the camel's walking all around. And finally, like the next morning, like it stops. It's like, oh, this son of a bitch. Now he's tired. And as Dustin Hoffman gets off the camel, he's like, my hips are locked. So he goes, 30 years later, every time he gets out of a car, you know, on a long car ride, he does that line, my hips are locked. Or if it's a hot day, because they're in the desert, it's like, it's going to be a scorcher today. I mean, of course it's going to be a scorcher. You're in the fucking desert. But but those are little tiny lines and things like that. And this is the way they deliver them. I think they have really good performances in this movie. And I know we'll disagree about that. But
the thing is I don't think the earnestness of their performances are bad. Like, I don't, it's not that I don't believe that they are not inhabiting their characters. I just feel like they do not have chemistry with each other. I feel like their dialogue doesn't bounce as well as it should with each other. And I feel like you can feel the chaos of the production around. And it's not just, obviously I knew this was considered like one of the biggest bombs ever. But the thing is I've liked bombs before. Like I've gone into movies where I mean, the list of bad movies or quote unquote bad movies that I like is like, you know, it's lengthy.
I wouldn't put that. I actually like that you don't like it, but you don't say it's a bad movie that you like or whatever. Because I don't think that's the case. It's fine if you don't like it. I think it's fine if you don't like it. But this is not The Room, okay? This is not something like that at all. It's not Showgirls.
I've never seen The Room, which is, I guess, good for me because people keep saying, like, go see The Room. It's like the most awful movie ever. I'm like, why? I don't have time to waste on that.
Well, you can do a double feature and then watch The Disaster Artist, which was about that. It's pretty cool.
But I do think that this movie is definitely a victim of the production that it was in, and I feel like it's definitely a victim of Hollywood excess, because you can tell, and I think that there's a lot of stuff in here that's been forced. You can feel they're like pushing and you know, comedy, in my opinion, you know, should be something that flows with ease, that, you know, seems easy but obviously isn't. And it seems like there's just so much in this movie that they're trying to make work, like, we're gonna make it work. Like,
well, there could be some of that, and I'll give you that, because that probably plays into the perfectionist thing with, like, if she's doing 50 takes or something, and that can start to come out. And there was a lot of money spent on this to make it look right, or this and that, and it is a little silly, because, you know, it seems like this idea about two guys in the desert that are bad songwriters and they're putting all this money behind it and have this amazing cinematographer. But to me, that kind of works in its favor. But I don't know if that's because I've seen it so many times and I actually think it's like pleasing to the eye to look at a lot of it. I think the colors, I think the way it was put together, I could disagree with you on some of that stuff. And I think that there's been a lot of a lot of people have changed, not changed their minds, but there's been some revisionism. Revisionism with this, because it's become a little bit of a cult movie that people like. In fact, I went and saw it at Tarantino's theater at the New Beverly. They had a screening, and it wasn't the kind of screening where you go in and like, okay, we're going to watch Plan 9. It's hilarious. Everyone there loved that movie and loved it because they thought it was really smart and funny, and they just liked it. They weren't there as a gag. And I was a little worried about that, because I'm like, okay, these guys are film aficionados. These are people that come to New Beverly, and they appreciate this movie on the merits of Elaine May, the performances, and you know, it's kind of like a middle finger to people that like said it was the worst movie ever made, because it's not, and it's actually really funny, and that's my opinion. I know we'll disagree, but even you who don't like it say that a lot of it's funny. So
I didn't say a lot of it's funny. I'd say that there's definitely bits in there that are funny, and there's definitely attempts at making things funny that don't quite land for me.
Right.
I'm also not going to say that I think it's a good movie. I don't think it's the worst movie ever made, but I can see how someone would like it.
Right.
Like,
and I would never say it's the best movie of all time. Like, I like it a lot. It's one of my top comedies, flaws and all, put it that way.
Really? I mean, that's the thing, Dave. It's like you've listed a lot of like really other movies. Why? So I'm just really, and there are a lot of other movies that.
But a lot of it's personal. I was 17, okay. 18 when I saw it. I saw it so many times. We repeated so many lines. There was even when we first got a video camera, we were like some beach house with a bunch of family. And we took the video camera because we're near some dunes and we reenacted that desert scene. Like that's how, and we knew it from memory because like, you know, we didn't have the tape or anything on it. So like, it's just so, I think part of it is also being part of a club. Again, that kid I played basketball with, like he went on to be a theoretical physicist. He went to MIT and Harvard. You know, this guy was really smart and he knew all these songs and we'd be playing basketball and like, and laughing about them. And to me, it was just this like camaraderie where it's like, you know, these people that kind of like it too. And it was kind of like a secret club. And
but the question that I wanted to ask you is, yes. I feel like that there are a lot of movies about entertainment and like these sorts of characters that have been made that are better made, are funnier, are kind of maybe even a bit more successful. So I'm just wondering.
Well, obviously more successful probably, but like well, I tell you, another one I love and that's kind of under the radar is King of Comedy. It's one
that's
of my favorites.
Yeah,
but a lot of people don't know about it. A lot of people think it's not good. They didn't
it's
get
fantastic.
It. Of course. Well, I'm glad you like that too, because that's another one. That's another one. I know all the lines to it. I think the performances are amazing. Like Jerry Lewis is amazing and that's Sandra Bernhard. Like, that's another one that's like this for me. Like this, it's just a slightly different era. I think that was 1983 when that came out.
Yeah,
but,
I think it might have been earlier. I'm not sure.
It was. But again, like I like kind of offbeat, weird comedies. And this is still in that wheelhouse. And it's because it was so maligned that I think it kind of gained in stature for me.
Yeah, this is, you want to hear something?
Sure.
This is something I feel should be remade. I feel like they trying to remake. I really do. I feel like you could take this script.
You probably like that Arthur remake with
No, God no. But
and the In-Laws. Did you like the In-Laws remake?
Yeah, no, not I didn't even
okay.
see it. Why would I go see that?
And see, the In-Laws was perfect, right?
The In-Laws is perfect, and it's funny because Ishtar actually
perfect.
Rips off a line, rips off a bit when they're getting shot from the helicopter. Warren Beatty goes
Serpentine.
Go. He doesn't say Serpentine.
No, he goes run at a crooked line.
Yeah, running a crooked line.
But I think that might have been a little nod, though. And I do that too all the time. And it's like it's not lifting. It's just kind of a nod to something else you like. I'm sure she thought the In-Laws was great too.
You say tomato, I say tomato. I mean that's the thing is I feel like that this if you took this and got a director who wasn't being harassed by her producer in the studio, and you know maybe shot it out in Joshua Tree, like or whatever. Desert that they shot the you know
okay who would you cast, Christian? I want to hear who would the cast of the new Ishtar be.
I don't know. I would have to honestly think about it. You know, when I was thinking about it, I was like in the heyday in the 90s this would probably be something that you would and I'm not saying that this is correct casting because you're gonna freak out, but I would say this is probably something that Jim Carrey probably would have gravitated toward or something like that, being that it's the sort of like, you know, downtrodden, you know, sort of guys who are trying to succeed in comedy. I don't know who, I mean.
Okay, I got it. It's Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt has Warren Beatty's role, right?
Okay.
And what's his name?
I was going to say, first of all, I would keep the characters their age. The bit that I would add is
Isaac Oscar as the Hoffman role. That would be great.
Isaac Oscar. Oh, no. No, 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 no. No, no.
No,
no, no, no. No, we have to think about this. This is something I would have to think about.
Oscar
but,
Isaac, sorry. I was looking.
Isaac,
I was thinking it was IMDb listing.
I was like, no.
Oscar Isaac, yeah.
I personally think that, like, if you took, I wonder if you can get Elaine May's, like, original script. It must be available somewhere. And I think that you could probably do, like, a really clean, like, nice production of this and recapture that sort of Bing Crosby thing. I think you're too close to it, Dave.
First of all, no one would do it, so it won't happen. And we won't have to suffer that Arthur remake syndrome.
Yeah, why not? Why not? I think you could probably
at that point you just do a different movie. Just do a different buddy comedy. I tell you what, there's not a lot of good buddy comedies anymore. And that was part of that Bill Simmons' podcast on The Ringer about Midnight Run, which is another great movie. But there's not, people don't do buddy comedies very well anymore. Like, they just, they don't exist. They're hard to write.
They're called Marvel movies now.
Well, number one, okay, I'll give you that. Number one, and they're hard, comedy is hard. And
you're not wrong.
And before we go, I did want to mention that one line at the end that, that Grodin has, and it's great because he gets called, like, you know, after all the shit hits the fan in this movie, and it, it is a big ending and stuff. He's like, yeah, it's a disaster. The Emir has to be replaced. You know, we have to replace the Emir, but that's not the biggest problem. We actually have to back an album with these guys and promote it. So it's like the CIA has to, like, have them, you know, like, put on a concert. It was so good. It was good.
And that scene, that's one of those scenes that I think it could have been tighter, and it just felt like shoehorned in.
You're talking about the end, like, or Grodin's scene?
I'm talking about Grodin's, like, scene. It to me, that bit is a prime
example. Classic Charles Grodin. I mean, I don't know how you can complain about that.
Classic Charles Grodin is what you said, the heartbreak kid, the lonely guy. What's another Charles Grodin? God, why can't
Midnight
I think
Run.
Of
it? I mean,
if you were going to pick great Charles Grodin performances, this would be on the bottom for me.
Seems Like Old Times, too. He was amazing and Seems Like Old Times.
Charles Grodin was like a legend. I think he's kind of a conservative nut job now.
No, he's not conservative at all. He's actually the opposite of that.
He had a talk show for a while.
Yeah, he's very liberal, put it that way.
Okay, if I'm wrong about that, I apologize.
You should apologize, because you don't want to be on his bad side. You remember his Letterman appearances?
But as far as I'm concerned, Charles Grodin, like, to me, was one of those actors, like, growing up, who I was like, would be excited to see in something. When I was watching this, I was like, please find me Midnight Run. Please find me The Lonely Guy. I want to reconnect with the Charles
He's so
Grodin
funny
actor.
In this. Like, the scene with the camel, and he's like moving the camel.
I feel like he has bits that are good, but his scenes go on for too long. There's not enough tightening. This film needed to be tightened.
You're wrong.
Tightness.
Wrong.
I needed some ab exercises. Tighten. I feel like it's a little flabby around the midsection.
Right.
Definitely the ending is just, I'm like, this is way too, by the ending, it gets like way too silly. And I feel like the ending is very rushed. Like they're doing a concert and she sits down and she's like, I love these guys. And I'm like, wait, what? There was no real connection between you and these guys, hardly ever in the movie. So I feel like there's definitely bits where the characters don't connect. I feel like it lacked a bit of character development that it needed. I don't think it's the worst movie in the world, and I'm not going to disparage you for liking it like you disparaged everyone who doesn't like this movie, because apparently you cannot trust me, and I'm not a smart person.
Well, I apologize if I said that, but it still stands.
If that's yeah, exactly. And now we can't be friends anymore.
Now we'll finish this in Long Beach. I'll see you in Long Beach, and we'll hash this out.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny is that Ishtar, well, you can watch it on Amazon Prime, which is how I watched it, but apparently
they have that on there now.
Yeah, it's on. Well, you have to pay for it.
Okay.
And when I went to Netflix Discs, because I am old school and I still have a DVD subscription through Netflix, it was not available on DVD. I was like, what?
Well, it was really hard to find. Like, in fact, there was these guys in Canada that had a documentary they made called Waiting for Ishtar, because they were Ishtar fans. And I only saw some clips or whatever, and they interviewed Charles Grodin, they interviewed some other people, but they were real, like, amateur guys. They weren't filmmakers. In fact, they went to an Elaine May screening of Ishtar in New York, and I think Warren Beatty might have been there or whatever, and they tried to film it secretly so they wouldn't be seen. But when they finally got the footage, because the guy wasn't looking through the viewfinder, like, it was just at the ceiling the whole time, so they couldn't use any of it. But it was kind of sweet, because they were like these two guys that just love this movie, and they were on a waiting list at the Toronto Library to get it, because it wasn't out on DVD or Blu-ray. There's like 40 people on this list, and they had to wait to finally get it. Now it's out on Blu-ray finally, but there's no extras or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, the Blu-ray is actually available on Amazon for like $10, and the DVD is. It's just odd to me that Netflix wouldn't be carrying it in their DVD library. I don't know why. Netflix, you should go on Amazon and buy yourself a copy of the DVD to have, so I don't have to pay Amazon for it next time, because I want my $4 back. But anyway,
I have a Blu-ray you can borrow. I have two of them, actually.
I should have borrowed. You have two of them?
I have two. I have one to give away to someone that's worthy.
You know what? Quite honestly, I probably should have just bought the Blu-ray, because, you know, these days I just buy discs because they're becoming cheaper and cheaper.
Right.
Why do I want to buy the streaming? But I wanted to get this, watch this in time for the podcast. So I did.
So you're the guy that still buys like DVDs from Walmart, like in the,
yep,
in the bins? Gotcha.
Not Walmart, but I don't know.
I think I saw somewhere where you went to a Walmart recently.
No, you would be wrong about that.
I think you said I had to go because it was the only thing open or something.
That was like 5 years ago.
All right.
I was traveling with my kid and she needed diapers and there was no other store around. So that's why I went into a Walmart.
You're such a purist, Christian.
I am a purist. Hey, fight the power. Whatever I got to do.
Right.
Right. Like I'm part of the problem. But anyway, no, I mean, Ishtar,
Give it a chance, people. I'll say this. At least give it a chance, because a lot of people love it. A lot of people hate it or whatever.
But
if you love it.
The database, it has 4.2 stars right now. I don't think a lot of people love it.
38% seem to give it good ratings on Rotten Tomatoes. 38%. That's pretty good. With 38%, you can be the most powerful person in the world, apparently, these days. So that's all you need is 38%.
Dave, no matter what, I still love you. And
all right.
Thank you.
You got through it.
What?
We got through it. We don't hate each other after this.
No,
of course not.
I honestly don't see how you see me, because I think you think that I'm just like gonna lose my shit. And
I've seen you lose your shit over some comics and things like that. It can happen.
Yeah, and it just happens unexpectedly. It's like the Hulk.
You know,
if you're ready for it, it's not going to happen. But it's when you're not ready for it, and it's like, oh, shit, David Banner just fucking flipped out.
Well, we will agree to disagree on Ishtar, but I'm glad you gave it a chance because, like I said, some people may like it very much. So you give it a shot. If you don't like it, great. If you like it, you really like it, like me, and you'll watch it again and again.
Absolutely. If you like it, I would not recommend watching.
Right.
That's just me. No, but I love you, Dave. Thank you so much for coming on to the Part-Time Fanboy podcast and discussing Ishtar with me.
My pleasure. It was the second time I was on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, we hope to have you on more if you want to. I mean, you're always welcome to come and chat. So
I would love to. I'm a fan. I'm a part-time fan of the Part-Time Fanboy podcast.
You should be a full-time fan.
All right. I'll try.
Everyone. But anyway, my guest is David Schrader. He is the co-creator of Baby Badass through Action Lab Danger Zone.
I co-created with Christian Horn.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
And he's also a filmmaker. Name some of the titles off of your short films.
Come and Knock, The Other Ray Charles. You can check this out on Highbrow, HYBRAU, our channel on YouTube, and actually Hyloflix, HYLOFLIX. It's our streaming service parody that is launching soon. And so Come and Knock, The Other Ray Charles, Back to the
Mercy.
No Mercy, 1992. It's not from 1992. It's like made to look like it's a trailer from 1992.
Yeah.
Back to the Bad, Break into the Future just came out. It's a great little mashup. And that's about it. And cool. Working on some other projects, working on a project with Eric Esquivel, this awesome writer that's doing a comic called Border Town right now. It's relaunching Vertigo. And we got a thing coming out called Magic Mullet that we're working on.
Nice.
And Baby Badass Volume 2 in the works. Spring 2019.
With Andy Taylor as artist, right?
Yes. Awesome. Yep.
Cool. All right. And we will be at Long Beach Comic Con this weekend. Our booth is
D20. Right? Yeah, D20.
D20, as in Dungeons & Dragons 20. Not
right.
D&D, just 1D. My name is Christian Horn, and this has been the Ishtar episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that great stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com, and we will be back soon with another episode. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
facebook.com.